Thanks, Jan. Hello, good morning. You're very welcome to the programme. Between now and nine, mad for slurry in Wexford, howling at the moon in Salt Hill, remembering the man, not the trophy, on the Curragh, when presidents meet in Mayo, and the choir that feels the rain on their skin in Galway. A bit of dry weather this week, and one of the farm rituals of the first part of the year is well underway. Since the first of the month, landowners everywhere have been allowed to spread slurry. Since the first of the year, the number of farms that have had to do this in a way that reduces emissions has increased hugely. And all of those tractors and tankers crisscrossing fields are part of a big and complicated picture that's right in the middle of water quality and climate change targets. Slurry spreading is now so technical a business and farmers are so busy with larger herds that increasingly it's a job that is outsourced to contractors. People like Irvin Rothwell outside Enniscorthy, County Wexford, who had his foot to the floor this week getting to as many different farms as possible. But thankfully he was able to spare a few minutes for Countrywide.
So we're going into the middle of this man's farm now, and we'll be able to see it on both sides.
How long are you doing business with him?
We do all this man's slurry, and I suppose we're with him for somewhere between 10 and 15. I'm no good on this year's thing, if you know what I mean.
Okay.
I said to him, do you mind if I bring Philip out your hazard? I said, he's around. Do you mind if we go up and see Paddy spreading an Amen puppet? And he said, yeah, no bother. And I said, can I go over the car road, the middle of the road? Middle of the field, and he said, yeah, open the gates there. And here he has them open for you, so feel honoured here.
The red carpet has been rolled out.
The red carpet is out for you.
Yes, no need exactly. For me to be hopping out and doing gates.
A 4-inch wide hose pipe is dragged through the grass behind a tractor that's spreading slurry.
Umbilical is a pump in the yard pumping the slurry out through a pipe to an applicator in the field.
The pipe runs over 1,000 metres all the way back down to slatted sheds from where slurry is being pumped under pressure. An umbilical slurry spreading system.
So no traffic on gateways, roadways, carways, and it's only the weight of the tractor in the field. A tanker is loading up a tanker with 9, 10, 11, 12 tonnes of slurry, plus the weight of the tank, plus the weight of the tractor, and going off out into your field and creating a lot of damage if you don't have good ground conditions.
The dribble bar at the back of the tractor drops the slurry from a few inches above the ground, replacing the splash plate system, which used to send brown rainbows arcing across fields, losing many tons of emissions to the atmosphere in the process. This umbilical system is appropriate for this time of year. In a few months' time, when the ground is considerably drier, Irvin will be pressing even newer technology into service.
So this tanker is for injection. This is our injection tanker.
What's the difference between dribble bar and injection? Is this now the new gold standard?
This is the percentage higher that you go in saving your ammonia, because instead of putting it along in a row on top of the ground, just under the grass, you're now cutting a slot an inch or an inch and a half deep and pouring the slurry into it, and it's dead level with the ground. Mm-hmm. So there's no overspill on the ground and your slurry is down in the clay where the roots want it.
And is that helping with soil compaction as well, loosening it up?
Exactly, but it's a summer month of the year machine. Like, there's no way that machine won't...
The injector setup alone would set you back 70,000 to 80,000 euro, which is in part why the last 10 years has seen a lot of outsourcing of slurry spreading to contractors like Irvin.
I noticed a figure. The amount of business being picked up by contractors has increased 75% in the last 10 years. It's just under €1 billion. That suggests to me a kind of a quiet revolution. While farmers are now having to spend more time concentrating on larger herds and what have you, they're outsourcing that land management work to people like you. Does it feel like there has been a shift in the tectonic plates in the course of the last 10 years in who's doing what?
Absolutely. Dairy farmers are too busy looking after stock. Their yards have got bigger, their numbers have got bigger, and yes, they outsource it. Added to the fact that with LESS and all of this, the close periods, a slurry is harder to do, if you know what I mean. So you need somebody more professional, like, you know, so.
Less. LESS, low emissions slurry spreading, the dribble bars and the injectors rather than splash plates, which sends a lot of nitrogen into the atmosphere. It is a critical part of getting agriculture to its legally binding climate change targets. Only 10% of a 25% cut has been achieved so far, so a lot more less will be needed. And since the beginning of the year, many thousands more small farms are now required to use LESS techniques. Easier said than done, though.
But I'm thinking about as well those awkwardly shaped little fields with hillocks and hummocks and megalithic tombs. They're not going to be patches of land that lend themselves to doing your job easily, are they?
No, and I wonder, will common sense prevail that there is some ground that is just not spreadable by LESS and is doing very well from being spread by splash plate? Now, is there a way that we can spread, let people spread with splash plate, only don't spread in the height of the summer when it's 24 or 5 degrees. Try spread it in dull conditions.
Or remove that slurry to somewhere else and only use protected urea on those farms.
Financially, it sounds not the thing to do.
But environmentally?
Yes, environmentally, maybe that's the thing to do with it, yes. Who's going to pay for it, if you know what I mean? Because that farm, that little farm, is using its slurry very well currently, and they're able to match it in and use it and grow their silage and all the rest, and now we have to export it somewhere.
But it can't be beyond the ability of man to be able to find some system to get a surplus product where it's not needed or can't be used to a place where it can be used, and to then subsidise the fella to use an alternative, a more environmentally friendly alternative.
Absolutely, and subsidises the bit that you said there, because these small little farmers, when you go to spread the slurry for them with a splash plate only, and you manage to agitate it in an hour and you manage to get it spread without any water coming in to thin it out for dribble bars, etc., it's still a fair old bill at the end of the year.
Irvin was being a little bit coy here, because as it happens, he has a working solution to this problem. But he only chose to reveal it to me as I was leaving.
This is the way this agricultural slurry end of it needs to go, in my opinion. Here is our site for holding our creamery sludge, and it's in the middle of lots of land. So,
what are we looking at? 30 metre squared?
Yeah, 35 metre square, yeah.
And how deep?
13 foot deep.
It's a lined lagoon for creamery sludge. Despite the unsavoury name, it's a byproduct of the cheese and baby formula industry that is rich in N, P and K, nitrogen, phosphorus and potassium, and is much sought after as a fertiliser by, among others, organic farms.
So you fill it over the winter, and then if you can get it spread onto your tillage ground and put it in the middle of a big tillage area or your tillage farm or what have you.
Your treatment of creamery sludge is a bit of a blueprint for how we might be treating slurry.
I think so, yes, as regards where you store it and to have enough storage and be able to use it when it's wanted.
But the polluter pays for you to take it away. You take some of that to pay for the storage, and then the end user who you deliver it to gets it for free. That's got a nice circularity to it.
It has a good ring to it.
So that means more facilities like this closer to or in the centre of a cluster of tillage farms, so that you can get it to them in that kind of time.
So if you had three or four tillage farmers beside one another and they all decided to pool in and build a lagoon between them and then take in the slurry and probably get a gate fee off of your dairy farmers that are under pressure, etc., put it in there and then use it themselves. You're killing four birds with one stone.
Irvin Rothwell in Wexford. Subsidising slurry lagoons. Not, I will grant you, the sexiest taxpayer investment in the world, but worth saying once again that the cost of not getting this right is going to be anywhere between 8 and 20 billion euro. So to a man whose personal wealth was measured also in billions, 13 of them. If you're into show jumping, the Aga Khan is a trophy. If flat racing is your thing, the Aga Khan is a grandstand at the Curragh. If you're an Ismaili Muslim, the Aga Khan is your spiritual leader. And if unsolved crimes are your thing, the Aga Khan was, of course, Shergar's owner. The fourth Aga Khan died on Tuesday. And if you're a trainer and former champion jockey like Johnny Murta, the Aga Khan was your boss, or rather your boss's boss for many years. Good morning, Johnny.
Good morning, Philip. How are you?
You're out on the gallops in the Curragh. He was an exotic name to most of us. What was the man like?
He was a wonderful man. We never rose his voice to me. You know, very calm. I'm here on the Curragh. He was the driving force behind the redevelopment of the Curragh. He knew, you know, we had a top class race course and he wanted to put a facility with it. So, I rode for him for 20 odd years. Very intelligent, played a big part in Irish racing, and I suppose with his studs and his broodmare ban, he was, you know, he's world renowned.
How involved was he in the breeding process? I mean, this wasn't just an owner who turned up in the parade ring. He was there from 3 years earlier when selections were being made, wasn't he?
Oh, he was. That was his baby. He loved that part of it. He got his team around him. They sat down. They decided which mare would go with which stallion, which would be suitable. You know, you just didn't pick a name out of the sky and says we'll put, you know, this stallion with this mare. There had to be a reason. He loved that. I think you can see when he led in those winners. Like, I always felt that he got huge enjoyment of it. But when you do think back 3 years earlier, he sat down with his team, he put the matings together. It must have given him a huge pleasure, you know, to lead in the what he produced three years later. And
of course, it gives you a pleasure to lead in the winner. But tell me about the mark of the man. How was he at losing?
He was good. He was a great loser. You know, once you sat down, he knew he didn't go out to mess up, but there was sometimes that it didn't go always to plan. But when you came back in and you gave him the debrief and you told him what happened, he could read a race very well. You didn't want to be coming in spoofing him. You needed to tell him exactly. He had these big binoculars. He used to carry these real big binoculars. And I used to think he could see what I was thinking. So I didn't take any chances. I told him directly how it was, good or bad, and he took it really well.
You had been barely out of short pants when Shergar was kidnapped. Did he ever talk about Shergar after you, or by the time you were riding for him, or had he just left that to the true crime fans?
I think he left that to the true crime fans. But the first race I ever remember watching when I was 11, 1981 Epsom Derby, I watched it with my uncle, who was big into racing. I didn't know much about racing. So it was a short few years later, I was riding in those colours. I was retained to ride for the Aga Khan. And now I'm training for the Aga Khan. So listen, all I can say was, you know, he's left a huge, you know, dynasty behind him. And he's got two of the best stallions in the world now in Giltown with See the Stars and France with Sayuni. He's got 100+ mares. Those famous colours, you know, everybody knows His Highness the Aga Khan's colours.
Indeed. That dark green and that bright red. Thank you so much, Johnny Murta. Take care of yourself. Rest in peace to the fourth Aga Khan, succeeded now by his son, the fifth Aga Khan. And I think his daughter, Princess Zara Aga Khan, is a bit of a trainer in her own right, so she'll probably, hopefully, take over operations at Giltown and Sally Mount Studs. Now, we have been asking you what you get up to these winter nights to keep you busy, connected, engaged with the world, which prompted Michelle Geraghty to get in touch to explain why at this coming week's full moon you might hear all sorts of unearthly howling and yelping coming from the water near the Salt Hill Promenade's iconic diving tower in Galway. Do not be afraid. It is the Blackrock Howlers who gather once a month under the full moon to chat, to swim, and, as the name suggests, to howl.
You, sir. careful, try to swim back against it. You may not be able.
That's Martin. He's a regular swimmer at Blackrock. But on the full moon, he's on the tower, shining a light on the steps and keeping tabs on people going in and out.
4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. Help one another over there!
The regulars even have a safety procedure in place for the windy nights like tonight.
The shower around the corner there, and there's a slipway down with a railing.
Oh, I know what you mean. Yeah.
So sometimes if you can't get back here, it's just that the waves take you down there. Yeah,
that's what we say, tower to shower.
Yeah.
Galwegian Paddy McNamara is the man responsible for all the madness.
The Howlers kicked off a couple of years ago. It was literally a handful of us just we might turn up on the full moon, and we wouldn't organise it, it was just that we were there. But you had this bunch that swam at 11:30 every day, but they never swam in the dark. And they just said, we'd love to try it. So that was, I said, OK, we'll go in October and then we'll have the dip. In they got, and there's a bit of crack. I had got glow sticks for them, so they had a bit of life for that particular one. There was a few little treats made when they came out after us, and they had a great laugh and a bit of crack, and then that was it.
Laura Brown is one of the well-known swimmers down here at Blackrock. I asked her about her first full moon swim.
I remember it vividly. It was October 2020. It was lockdown. Sure, no one could be going to the nightclub or the pub. So we all had to be down here for 9 o'clock to descend the steps of Blackrock and just let your inner wolf come out and just let go and release all the stresses that you've had. It's just unbelievable.
But the Blackrock Howlers aren't all daily dippers like Laura. And it made me wonder, what possesses people to come down for a swim in the cold and the dark?
Well, the last full moon, I was walking the prom and I could just hear all this screaming and glow sticks in the water. And I was going, I'm definitely doing that the next time. And it didn't disappoint.
It's like a ritual, I think. There's kind of a feeling of being held by the ocean, and then the moon is pulling the ocean and the moon is pulling us. It's slightly spooky and pagan, but also great crack and everybody's here. So it's a social thing as well as that.
But aside from the crack, there's lots of other benefits to cold water swimming.
It raises the endorphins in the body and generally has a very positive effect on people's mental well-being. People find that they feel a lot better after it and that it boosts them. And like, I'll agree with that. Like, so you come down some mornings and it looks miserable. Why am I doing this? And you get in and you have your little dip or a swim and you come out and you feel a lot better.
How did you find that?
Great, it was so warm.
Good, are you a regular? Do you come here every month?
No, I was part of cold member, so I'm like used to the cold water, but this is my first howl. So great.
Oh, I absolutely loved it. Just blissful, peaceful, at the same time invigorating, and the community spirit of it is so uplifting.
It was nice and calm, and so I just stayed in when everyone went out. Peaceful, I love it, especially when the full moon as well. So this is my first time this year, so getting back into it again.
Baltic, brilliant, life affirming. I've been to the land of Chernanog. Now for cake.
Paddy's homemade cakes are a highlight of every full moon swim. A lovely treat to look forward to when you're dressed and warm.
What's on the menu today, Paddy?
We have lemon cheesecake, orange Toblerone and ginger cheesecake and rocky roast.
Gathering for the cake and the chats after the swim tells you everything you need to know about the community down here. It feels like the kind of place where strangers become friends.
My mum is bridesmaid at his mum's wedding.
Yes, yeah, we're cousins.
We're proper cousins.
We're Black Rock cousins, yeah. As well.
The community has developed through the swimming. You have the different crews, as I call it, the early morning, the 9 o'clock. You have to drop kids to school. You'll have the 11:30 retired and the evening crews. And people look out for each other and become very good friends as well from within those groups. So I think that's the positive aspects. It's a focal point for meeting people, and it's an environment where people come in. How are you, Mary? How are you, Mick? That's all they know, and they say hello, and that bit of interaction.
This full moon swim was one of the first things I came across when I moved to Galway, and I just couldn't believe how fun it was and how friendly people were. The glow sticks, the howling, and the coffee and cakes. It was just great crack. And then the next time I was down for a swim, I recognised a few faces, and there was just, you know, all of a sudden I was meeting a few new people in my new city.
As the crowds diminish, I found Paddy sweeping out the dressing room.
It's a facility we use. We should look after ourselves. It's a community. So if we all do a little bit, I think it makes life a bit better for everyone.
Locked up. Oh, it's ready for the morning crew.
As the full moon continues to rise, another monthly ritual comes to an end. But the Blackrock Howlers will be back next month for more swimming, more howling, and more of Paddy's delicious treats.
and watch the sun go down on Galway Bay.
Well, guys, back down here in our half air for a dip.
See you then.
Oh,
yeah.
See you tomorrow night,
probably. See you, bye. Bye. Oh, see you tomorrow night, yeah.
Laura Brown and Paddy McNamara with Michelle Geraghty in Salt Hill. Next full moon, the snow moon, is on the 13th of February. That's next Thursday. If you want to let us know about your winter nights, email us, please. Countrywide@rte.ie.
Email countrywide@rte.ie. Countrywide on RTE Radio 1.
What Johnny Murta was just saying about the Aga Khan's investment in racing infrastructure in the east of the country leads me on to our next topic this morning. Where does most investment happen? Where is most wealth generated? Where in Ireland do people have the most money in their pockets? John Daly is an economist working with the Northern and Western Regional Assembly, which was established about 10 years ago to foster regional development. He was very interested to read the findings of the most recent statistics on county incomes and regional GDP published this week by the CSO. More on that in a second. John, good morning. How are you?
Morning, Philip, and thanks very much for having us on the show.
Will you remind us to begin, please, which counties does the NWRA, the Assembly, cover?
Yeah, so the Northern Western Regional Assembly would specifically be focused on the eight counties of Galway, Mayo, Roscommon, Donegal, Sligo, Leitrim, Cavanagh and Monaghan. So I suppose as a public body, our overarching remit, as you said, is the support and delivery of balanced regional development. I suppose, in relatively speaking, we are a relatively new body. I know it's only about 10 years, but in comparison to the history of the state, the regional assemblies, effectively our responsibilities, you know, they've ranged from acting as the managing authority of the European Regional Development Fund, developing policy. But I suppose what brings us to yourself today is, as part of our remit, is to support development and
well,
research.
Tell me to that end, will you, John, please? How much of the population lives in that region and how much of the big project investment does the region get?
Yeah, so based on the latest census data, the Northern Western region of Ireland accounts for just under 18% of Ireland's population, specifically 17.6%. Now, we would have released what we call a regional infrastructure tracker a few months ago, and we kind of looked at the distribution of investments associated with public sector tenders worth more than 1 million euros and in public sector tenders worth more than 20 million euros. And despite the fact the Northern Western region of Ireland accounts for 17.6% of Ireland's population, the region only accounted for 9.9% of all the investment associated with public sector tenders worth more than 1 million euros. So
there is a disparity there.
Below average.
There's a disparity there then. But tell me, how do disposable incomes look comparatively compared to Dublin?
Yeah, so based on the latest, I suppose, figures from the CSO, which were released this week, the average disposable income per person in the Northern Western region of Ireland amounted to just over 26,000 per person, which was below the corresponding level of just over 29,000 in the Eastern Midland region. Now, I suppose, Philip, for your own listeners' sake, the Eastern Midland region covers everything from Dublin and across to the Midlands, but specifically the average disposable income level in Dublin was just over 32,000. Now, it's no surprise to see that was followed by Cork and Limerick, which obviously we associated with large metropolitan areas, whereas the lowest level of disposable income in the state was in Longford at just over 22,000, followed by Laois and Donegal. But what's very interesting, Philip, about the data is that it shows that over the past decade, regional inequalities in terms of disposable income have progressively risen. So just to give you an example, a decade ago, the gap between the Northern Western region and the leading Eastern Midland region in terms of disposable income per head of population was around 3%. Now that gap has risen to 10% as per the latest figures, whereas we're seeing a similar level in the county level as well.
But John, anybody listening in the Eastern Midlands or in Dublin would say, fair enough, the cost of living is so much more expensive in these areas.
Absolutely. And look, and take your point on that. And like, while housing costs in absolute terms are higher in the greater Dublin area, I think it is important to note that the level of disposable income in a region or a county reflects many economic factors, not just housing costs. You know, it reflects population flows, employment composition, investment opportunities. And notably, over the past decade, when we've seen these regional disparities in terms of income rising, average house prices in the northern western region have actually risen at a faster rate than the eastern Midland region. Just to give your listeners an example here, over the past decade or so, when this disparity has risen, average house prices in the northern western region have risen just over 99% compared to price inflation in the eastern Midland region of just over 70%. So while whatever is driving the rising gap, housing costs not necessarily are the driving factor. I think one of the biggest problems we're seeing is that much of this disparity can be explained by the economic underperformance of the northern western region compared to national trends. And I think this was exemplified by the fact that the European Commission actually downgraded our region's economy from a leading economic status known as a more developed region to a lower economic status known as a transition region. Okay. Now, that's not to say, Philip, that the economy hasn't risen. It just hasn't kept up the pace with the rest
just
of the country.
Just not as fast as everywhere else. No, I get that. But there is another really interesting index here, and it is that in the region that you're representing, people are shown to be less trusting of government than elsewhere. Do you think that these gaps in income, these gaps in investment, mean that the state is kind of losing the dressing room in the Northwest?
Yeah, well, just to give your listeners some context there, I suppose that data stems from the European Commission's Eurobarometer, which effectively sends out surveys to residents across the regions in the EU. And what's been interesting is that, as you touched on there, the percentage of people that mistrust central government or national institutions is notably higher in the northern western region in comparison to the other regions under Project Ireland 2040. Now, research from the OECD would note that in countries where regional disparities are rising, they tend to be associated with relatively higher levels of mistrust from rural residents in more rural-orientated regions. And to compact this, one of the OECD's key recommendations is that we need to increase more regional autonomy, provide more powers and responsibilities to the regional and local authorities. Obviously, it brings decision-making closer to the residents that are actually affected on the ground. And your listeners might be aware of this, Philip, but Ireland is actually one of the most centralised government systems in the OECD. Just under 10% of all government expenditure in Ireland is from local and regional authorities, but that's well out of kilter with the corresponding norms in Europe and across the OECD, like, say, Denmark. Just over 60% of all expenditure is from local and regional authorities. So there's a lot more regional autonomy there, say, for example.
Right, your remedy to this is a wish list of large infrastructural investment projects. I'm going to give you 30 seconds to start on that list, and then I'm going to ruthlessly cut you off when I run out of time. Go for it.
That's fair. No, our first key recommendations, we want to see ring-fence funding for under the National Development Plan. We want specifically, as a starting point, to deliver our 13 priority projects that we outlined in the Regional Infrastructure Tracker, along with our projects committed to under our Regional Spatial Economic Strategy. Like, these range from reasonable projects that can be delivered, such as the Donegal 10T projects, the redevelopment of the N17, but also the expansion of our the Atlantic Technology University and University of Galway, as well as more environmentally sustaining projects such as the Western Railway Corridor and more dual track lines across the region.
All right.
As well as...
Oh, God, you are actually stopping. You must be the only person that's ever come on this programme and taken the hint to stop talking when I said it. John Daly, you're very good. Thank you very much for joining us this morning. NWRA for more information on that wish list of 13 investment projects that John is looking for. Well, it seems like no time at all since we were congratulating Elaine Houlihan on her election as 39th president of Machrana Fermor. Now she joins me in studio as she is in the departure lounge, so to speak. Good morning. Good morning to you. As a young farmer, generational renewal was at the front of your mind when you were elected. You had words with the new Minister for Agriculture, Martin Hayden, very recently on his farm succession scheme. What did you say to him?
We are actually looking for commitment. It's in the programme of government that they are going to put in a succession scheme. We actually want to see action. As we know, paper never refused ink is what I literally told him, that if we do not get I suppose, success for succession and generation renewal. I also did tell him that his office is irrelevant. There won't be a Minister of Agriculture going forward if we can't gain the next generation.
If the government doesn't get this right, what do you think is at stake here?
The whole agricultural sector in Ireland is at stake, Philip. If they don't get this right and don't give the young people the opportunity to get into farming, there is going to be no farming in Ireland. As you can see with the CSO figures, in 3 years, it went from 6.9% of farmers under the age of 35 to 4.3%. What's going to happen in another 3 years if they don't take action right now?
In fairness to the Minister for Agriculture, though, is this thorny issue of succession not really more about families beginning and having awkward conversations than it is about anything that the government is going to be able to do?
Look, that is a factor, but that's something that we as a society has to normalise. We have to normalise that conversation of succession around the kitchen table, because the minute you bring up succession around a kitchen table, it draws silence, because nobody wants to talk about getting older, dying or conflict that's associated. Weren't you better off being around the table having this discussion? For a young person, we want to know if we have a future in farming. We need to know what's happening in the next 5 years. Are we going to be heading off travelling, getting a different job? Do we need to go to college, do a different degree? Or is the family farm going to be ours so we can actually farm?
You asked the new EU Agriculture Commissioner Christoph Hansen what the next cap was going to do to grow this current crop of under 35 year old farmers. It's only 4% at the moment, isn't it, in this country? What would you like to see him do?
I suppose the biggest thing here in Ireland, in our cap, we have no installation aid. I asked, would he actually put in a mandate across every country that there would be a percentage of the cap used for installation aid to help young farmers start up? It's something, I suppose, look, I got politicians answer back, which, look, he hits every buzzword that was required in the answer. But now we
are
meeting.
The mood and the sentiment certainly seems to be the right thing.
Yeah, 100%. Look, we're meeting him again at the start of March, and we are going to be following up to see what can we actually get in concrete for the next cap. And I suppose, look, that's going to be up to the next president of MACRA too, to fight that fight as well. As I'm in the departure lounge, as you said, Philip.
You're a bit young to be in the departure lounge. That was perhaps a little bit cruel of me. You are a MACRA baby. What does that mean?
Yeah, I am a MACRA baby. Both my parents met in MACRA. My father was involved in Limerick County MACRA and my mother joined, and I suppose the rest is history and I'm here now.
Because it is a pretty important thing, particularly now as farming tends to be a little bit more of a lonely place, the kind of connections that MACRA is able to help form.
Yeah, 100%. Like, we offer a social outlet to rural dwellers, and that's absolutely vital for a lot of people that are farming. As you said, it is so isolating because you're on the farm. The animals can't talk back to you. Like, that's the big thing here. It's about getting people out, and getting people social is our big thing as well in MACRA, along with the lobbying.
Well, as he sat in that seat, the Minister for Agriculture said the reason he got out of farming and into politics, God help him, was precisely because he was such a social creature. The other big aspect of your presidency was not unrelated, was mental health.
Yeah, look, when I came into the presidency, for people that don't know me, I'm a physio. So I came in as a healthcare worker with a farming background, and mental health was a massive thing that I noticed was affecting the farming community. And we have an initiative in MACRA called Make the Move. So that was one thing that I wanted to, I suppose, grow and develop in my presidency. And I'm delighted to see where it is at the moment. One of my big things was to kind of underpin everything we're doing with the research that's out there. So we teamed up with the UCD Agri Mental Health Group that's led by Tomás Russell and Louise McHugh. And like, the research that they're doing is showing that like 22.8% of farmers are at risk of suicide. Like, that's worrying. So
it's very worrying. But what can you do in practical terms? Because the nature of farming now is that with expanded herds, with the more complex business, with all of this increased regulation, that there are only so many hours in the day, and most of those hours have to be spent on your own.
Yeah, I look, through Make the Move, we are trying to think of different initiatives to get farmers thinking. Like, one thing that we launched was a U-book. It's a small little book that you can write down the cattle numbers on, but there's questions at the end of it that just pose you to think, do you need help? What went well today? There's different things there. We have a helpline, and I suppose the biggest thing with our helpline is that we're all from a farming background at the end of it. We understand the struggles that you're currently facing. Like, that's the big thing that we have, I suppose, in Make the Move, that is making the impact in rural communities.
Do you remember the helpline number off the top of your head?
No, that's the one thing I can never remember off.
We'll get it before the end of the
I'll probably end up giving out my number or something.
Right. Apply the brakes. Take a really sharp right turn. I'm thinking that Valentine's Day is coming up next Friday, isn't it? In your role as president, and I don't think this is in the constitution of Macra, you ended up being a bit of a matchmaker.
Yeah, look, I took on that job of trying to match a couple of people, and I could probably have my own festival now at the moment, but look.
You were successful four times over.
Aye, I've been successful four times.
Now, hang on a second, is that four relationships or four marriages?
Four relationships, maybe working on number five at the moment.
You're single yourself.
Yep.
Is it easy, given, as I said, the pressures of farming, the pressures of the presidency of Macra, to get out there?
For me, it is extremely hard, I suppose. Look, I'm a woman in power. I suppose that can be an awful turn off as well. My life is so busy, it's impossible to make time. Even if I did have a partner, it would be impossible to make time for them.
A woman in power rubbing shoulders with one of the previously most powerful men in the world. How did you end up finding yourself in the room with Joe Biden?
I still don't know how I managed ending up in that room. I was in work in Limerick at the time because it was only at the start of my presidency. It was actually, I think, the first engagement I had as Macra president. I got a phone call from the Oris and I didn't believe them. I thought it was one of the lads in the office winding me up. I was like, yeah. I was very hostile on the phone.
How rude were you?
Extremely rude. I was so hostile. I was like, yeah, Paul, put that on the email. Then the email came and I was eating my lunch and I'll never forget this. I dropped the roll out of my hand. I was like, oh my God, I was so rude on the phone. And then I arrived up to the Oris, I turned around and I asked the security man, I was like, well, is there many people gone in? And he goes, a couple of hundreds. So I thought I'd be sitting there, you know, on stage left.
If you get to shake hands, you'd be lucky.
Yeah.
But
then all of a sudden, arrived into the Oris, was taken into Michael Lee's sitting room, and I was one of seven to meet Joe Biden. And
what did you talk to him about?
Just general chit chat. He really wanted to know about like the relevance of Macra and I suppose my role, because I was only coming into this at the time. And then obviously came up about derogation because it was quite topical at the time. What he turned around and told me, his biggest problem was the poultry and he didn't know what to do with their manure. Now, he didn't say manure either. He used a different word. But like, look, I won't say that on the radio.
Fascinated to know how, if the calendar had shifted slightly, how interested the current incumbent would have been in that conversation about the nitrates derogation.
Yeah.
What would you say to your successor, whoever that person is?
I suppose the biggest thing is not to change who you are for the role. That was the one thing that I said when I came in as Macra president, was that I was never going to change who I was. Yes, is there a comment saying that I'm not the most polished at times, I could come out with anything, but that's who I am. That's who I've always been. I didn't change for the role. And I think that's the biggest thing. The biggest mistake you can make is changing yourself to fit a role, because you have to be true to yourself.
Elaine Houlihan, congratulations. Well done. Thank you very much and continued success.
Thank you.
Let us finish this morning by returning to our winter nights theme. What you're doing to keep engaged with the outside world until that stretch in the evening returns. Ahead of National Singing Week next week, Brenda Donoghue got her do-re-mis together and went to a rehearsal in the Clare Galway Community Choir. Their first rehearsal back since Storm Éowyn. Brenda tiptoed into rehearsals where the musical director Ciara Rose Sheeran was in full flow. Oh yeah, yeah.
Choir is about 3.5 years old. We came together after the lockdown. People are travelling in from all around rural Ireland. Well, I suppose they are. Yeah. Lovely Clare comes all the way down from Athlone. So we have a beautiful community of women here. Men are always welcome. They're just a little bit shy in rural Ireland in choirs.
It'd be a great place to meet a woman if they came.
I tell you now. I think the joy that I find in this particular group, because I'm a choir director of three choirs and each choir presents its own personality. This is a tribe that have made me feel very welcome in and of myself, because, you know, some of us are on the spectrum, including me, and so I'm a bit quirky, or as we like to refer ourselves as spice bags. So we were a little peppery some nights, we come in, we're a bit moody some nights, and we just laugh because we're all in a journey together. It's the sense of community. The minute the storm hit, everybody was hit quite badly with it. And immediately I opened up the WhatsApp group and it's like, okay, who needs this? Where are you? And the conversation was huge in the group and people reached out if somebody didn't have gas. How can I help you? Do you need me to bring you a dinner? Do you want to come up to the house for a shower? My power's back. Is your power back? How are you? Washing. 5 loads of laundry coming down to you in a minute, you know. But it's the sense of support and just friendliness and kindness and thoughtfulness that just very naturally comes out of this group of women.
You mentioned the importance of community and the washing. Mary, can I come over to you?
We lost power for about 5 days and school was coming and panic. I had to get washing, so I was going round Galway with my bags of washing for somebody to wash it for me. And that's how I ended up doing it. And even we had no power, so our porridge, I sent a picture to the WhatsApp group. And my husband, he's making his porridge outside in the barbecue in the dark with a torch. And he's minded this. And that's how we got through it. And that's the only way we got through it.
Before I hear you sing, I'd love to get a sense of why you got involved in the choir, what it means to you.
I'm Helena McGrath and I'm living in Clare Galway now, so I'm married to a farmer, so it's good to get out and about. And, you know, it's great to come here and do something for myself as well. It's really appreciated at home as well when I do go out.
Yes. Tell me how the storm affected you. Were you affected on the farm?
So we were out of power till the 31st, so that was last Friday, in the house, and then on the farm till last Monday. Yeah, so everything came back and we're there now, but I think farmers in particular are very resourceful and they manage.
Teresa Kilgannon is my name. Myself and my neighbour were looking for like some kind of choir to join, and we heard of this. And I had lost my son, so it was kind of my mental health. I wanted to kind of just do something for myself and join the choir 3 years ago. Then last April, unfortunately, I got diagnosed with breast cancer. Mm-hmm. I have never seen a crowd rally around somebody like they have rallied for me, and they have just been unbelievable. They're like every day there's a text, there's a phone call, there's something at the door, there's a package, there's I can't even put into words really how much these people mean to me. And they've been through thick and thin. They've just been amazing.
Somebody's on a crutch. Oh,
wasn't me.
Hi, what's your name?
I'm Marie Laffey. I live here in Clare Galway. I'm injured. I fell running to meet my husband on a Christmas date. Christmas. Yeah, we do a tradition of a Christmas date for each other when I wasn't working about 15 years ago. And I said, everyone else is having Christmas parties and I'm not having any Christmas party. So we started a tradition that we'd meet every Christmas and have a Christmas party for ourselves. So I fell running across the bridge in town. Oh. But like...
There's something romantic about that, isn't there?
I fell a second time for him. But I work in the university and I work in the Career Development Centre in the University of Galway, and I'm constantly supporting students, and all day you're giving of yourself. And like everybody's saying here, it's something I do for myself because I give up myself to everybody else, but I wasn't prioritising myself, as many mothers don't. And particularly working mothers, we have to go out and work and then we have to come home and look after families. And so this is my way of giving something to myself and prioritising my needs.
What's your name? Tell me a little bit about yourself.
Hi, my name is Anna Cormican, and I love to sing. I've always loved to sing. But I had an operation when I was 15 and the doctor said to me, of course, you'll never be a singer.
What operation did you have?
I had 7/8 of my thyroid gland removed. And they told me after the operation I'd never be a singer. And as a 15-year-old, I've carried that all through my life, and I didn't sing, and I've loved singing, but I wouldn't do it. And the thing about this choir is it's not about perfection. It's about the joy. It's about coming and singing with your heart and your soul and having fun and going out happy. And that's what I do. And I haven't looked back since I joined. Wonderful. So many years wasted, like, but I'm not giving up now.
Okay. You're practising Natasha Bedingfield's song, Unwritten. Mm-hmm. That has particular resonance with the community choir here.
So I suppose we were just chatting about this a while ago and coming to the realisation that every year has kind of had a song that stood out for us. And so now we're going into another new year for everybody. It's going to be a new chapter. We've braved a storm that's happened for the first time after, 100 years, something crazy like that. And our stories are still We're still living, so not everything has been written yet. But that's the concept of our stories are unwritten. And, you know, get out there, dance in the rain, smash the puddles. You got it?
Yes.
All right, let's do it.
Brenda Donoghue there showing remarkable restraint, not actually joining in and leading the choir. If you want to get involved in National Singing Week, more details, singireland.ie. If you want me to shut up and let you hear more, here you go. In the Countrywide Choir this morning, Liam Mullen, soprano, Amandine Passo-Devine, tenor, bass, Brenda Donoghue will sing any part so long as she gets the solo. Ear to the Ground Thursday evening, folks, Sinead Mooney on the way with the news, or with playback after the news at 9. Have a great weekend.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player.